Okay, we're just picking up, and so apologies if there was some issue at your end. On chapter 4 is where we're picking up today, so chapter 4 of Esther. And at this stage, don't forget, what's happened is that the news has gone out to the entire empire that all the Jews are to be slain on the final month of the year, on the 13th day of Adar. That's what you class as fairly bad news if you were a Jew. All of you, all the mums and the granddads and the kiddywinkies, all of you, if you're Jewish, the king has sent out an edict, and of course the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be rescinded, saying that you are all to be slain. Wow, that's bad news. Verse 1, when Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry, as I guess we all might if we were Jewish. He went as far as the square in front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. You might go as far as that, but not past it. This is the king. He's a very proud and arrogant man. Not going to turn up wearing sackcloth and smelly old clothes anywhere near the king. Verse 3, and in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So this was bitterly bad news, you know. If you're a Scot and you heard that all Scots are to be exterminated on a particular day of the year, you wouldn't be thinking, uh-oh, that's bad news. Maybe time to start adjusting my accent, try and sound like I come from Wisconsin or Texas or somewhere. This was bad news. And so all these Jews were just lying on the ground, weeping and wailing and gnashing their teeth. Verse 4. So Esther's maids and the eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them because they've said, look, you know, your cousin or your guardian, whatever they saw him as, is out there in sackcloth and ashes and bawling and squalling and crying. And so Esther's really puzzled by this. So Esther, verse 5, called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he'd appointed to attend her. She gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. Why are you in sackcloth and ashes? So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews, which wouldn't be Haman's own money, be what he would plunder from all the Jewish merchants and tradesmen and so on. Verse 8, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Mordecai thinks, well, Esther is a Jew and she's now queen. She has access to the king. I'm going to ask her to go before the king, seek his help, seek deliverance. So, verse 9, Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. And this is going to cause a problem now. So Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai, which was, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So actually, it turns out to be very dangerous to approach King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, because the guy is obviously very self-important, and how dare you enter his presence unless he's called for you. If you do enter his presence, it depends on the mood he's in. If his stomach's a bit upset from his breakfast, he'll just sort of scowl at you, wave across to some soldiers, you'll be dragged off and executed. If he feels a bit better and you wander into his presence and he's in a good mood, he'll hold out this golden scepter, and that means that you're okay. You can come forward. You can communicate. So she's saying, actually, Mordecai, cousin Mordecai, it's not that easy. I can't just go and see the king. In fact, a month has passed since the last time I saw him, so this is not an easy thing to do. Verse 12, so they told Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, Mordecai says, if you don't help out Esther, relief and deliverance will arise from some other place. He doesn't mention God here. Doesn't mention God's name. Perhaps that's what he had in mind, that God might raise up someone else, but God's name is just not mentioned anywhere in this book. And yet notice what he says finally, who knows whether the reason you are where you are, the place where you are, with the people that you're with, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for just such a special time. Is it strange that you are perhaps the right person in the right place at just the right time? I guess he's implying, has all this happened providentially? Is this the invisible hand of God, my cousin Esther? It just so happens that a Jewish girl is queen of Persia at this precise time when the Jewish nation is facing extermination. Did it just happen? And obviously, Mordecai is wondering himself. He says, in verse 14, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And I guess we could say there's just too many things just happening here for it to just be coincidental. There's clearly the invisible hand of God intervening here, opening a door here, closing a door there. You can't see God's hand at work. And yet, here is Esther, just the right person, in just the right place, at just the right time. Strange and amazing. And of course, in our lives, you and I rarely are visited by an angel. Rarely, I suspect, do we get visions in our bed at night. Well, not real ones anyway. Dreams, I suppose, if you had too much cheese earlier. And rarely do we hear the voice of God. And yet, who knows why we're sometimes in a certain place, at a certain time, in a certain situation. Who knows? Why are we there? How do we get there? How did this come about? And of course, at times, although we will not necessarily have the proof, it can be quite clear looking back that God was there in the background, just opening a door here, closing a door there, moving us a bit to the left, a bit to the right, stop where you are, wait a day or two, and we just don't see it. And yet, who knows? Anyway, carrying on verse 15. And of course, so that meant that really Esther had quite a difficult sort of challenge, because if she's going to go into the king, it's going to be a question of life and death for her. So Esther told them to return this answer to Mordecai. Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is actually against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Then Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. So it's not that easy for Esther at this stage. She knows that if she just waltzes off to the king, who knows? She might be okay. He might hold out the golden scepter, or she might be dead next morning. because the law is that if he doesn't hold out the golden scepter, you are to be executed. And if she's killed, well, first of all, she's dead. And secondly, it would seem then that perhaps the Jewish nation might disappear, because she looks like being, at this stage, the only salvation they've got. There's a young woman who is married to King Ahasuerus. And so I guess those 3 days when she was fasting were tricky days, wondering about how's this going to work? Is it going to be a good outcome, or these are my last 3 days on the earth? Oh, wow. And of course, you know, she could have remained quiet and just thought, well, okay, Uncle Mordy says go and tell him, but I think I'm okay here. Nobody knows I'm a Jew yet, because she's not revealed that. I think I'll just look after myself here. Bad luck about the others out there and the rest of the world, but in this world, you've got to look after yourself. Look after number one. I'll just remain silent. She could have done that, but she was obviously a better character than all of that. And of course, there are times when you need to stand up and speak, and there are times when it's wiser not to. If you hold your place there just for a moment, look at Ecclesiastes 3. Don't lose your place. We're coming back in a moment. If you go to Ecclesiastes, that's moving further towards the back of the Bible. So you've got Psalms, Proverbs, and then Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verses 1 and 2 and 7. I think we know this fairly well. I think there's a couple of songs out there also. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 and 2, just to get the introduction, then verse 7. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Then lots of other things down to verse 7. A time to tear and a time to sow, and notice, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. It may require wisdom to decide when to do either. But there are times when you need to zip your lip and be quiet and say nothing. And then there are times, like here with Esther, there are times when you have to stand up and speak. Simple as that. And so this was that sort of time in young Esther's life. Let's go back then to Esther and pick up in chapter 5 now. So she's chosen to go ahead to fast, and she's going to now speak up on behalf of the Jewish people, and of course probably herself. Chapter 5 and verse 1. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half my kingdom." So thankfully, it just so happened that the king was in a good mood. You know, it could have gone either way. But it just happened, thankfully, that the king thought, "Oh, it's young Esther, my queen," and he holds out the golden scepter and says, "Come along, I'm in a good mood today. What do you want? Ask for anything you want, and you can have it up to half my kingdom." That's probably not literal, it just means, you know, I'm going to be pretty generous today. So what do you want? You know, you're my favorite, you're my queen, what would you like? And we don't see, you know, God's hand exactly here anywhere. There's no miracle, it's just the king says, "Oh, Esther, haven't seen you for a while. Hey, come on over. Touch this golden scepter. I'm in a great mood today. What would you like from me? I'm so generous today. You can have anything you want. Oh, even up to half the kingdom." No miracle. And yet, it just happened. Or did it just happen? Again, hold your place there. Look at Proverbs 21:1. Proverbs 21:1. Proverbs 21 and verse 1 says, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, He, God, turns it wherever He wishes. Now, I guess most of the time, kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers just do their own thing, end of story. But if God in heaven wishes a king to make a particular decision, the king will make that decision. It says here, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever He wishes. So one would have to, I guess, suspect that when Esther appeared before the king that morning, the king's heart was in a very generous mood. Would that be the invisible hand of God leaning upon Ahasuerus to be generous? Probably. So back to Esther 5. So the king answered and said, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman," he's the bad guy, "come today to the banquet that I prepared for him." Then the king said, "All right, bring Haman quickly, so that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Because if the king wants something done, it gets done in a hurry. Go get Haman immediately. At the banquet of wine, verse 6, the king said to Esther, "Okay, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What's your request? Up to half my kingdom, it shall be done." And Esther could have said, "I want all the Jewish people to be saved, delivered," but she didn't. This time she was silent. A time for silence, because the time to speak would be, in her view, and probably, I would imagine, God was involved here, so that she just happened to want to delay. Now, whether she was delaying because she was a bit nervous about, how do you raise this topic? I mean, this is pretty tricky. He doesn't know I'm a Jewess. He knows nothing, and it's quite a request to say, "You've sent out an edict, king, like the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed, but I want you to change it." Oh, that's a tricky one. So maybe she was just chickening out. Anyway, she said, verse 7, "My petition request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So off to the second banquet, apparently. And she's very courteous, you can see here. And I mean, there must be reasons why he favored her, I guess, good looks. But also, she's very respectful talking to the king. You know, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king," and she's always addressing him very politely and very respectfully, and I guess that must be part of her allure to him. But she says, "Really, I'd love you to come back tomorrow for yet another banquet." It just so happens that that works out even better than trying to raise the point there. If she'd raised the point there, "Please release the Jews," it might have worked, but the way it did work out, as we see, is far better. Verse 9, "So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart, because, wow, me and the king and the prince and the queen, whoo, am I important or what? But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai." Remember, it's Mordecai's refusal to bow and pay homage that brought about the casting of the lots, the Purim, and the date to exterminate the Jews. Because Haman was just so super-duper self-important. That Mordecai, the Jew, won't bow before me? So here he sees him, and again, he's wrathful. "Nevertheless," verse 10, "Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them," that's his friends, because he is so important. "Haman, got to call my friends together, tell them about my banquet with just me and the king and the queen. Whoo, am I special or what?" "So Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, all the ways in which the king had promoted him, how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover," Haman said, "besides all of that, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And believe it or not, tomorrow, Haman the Mighty, am again invited by her, along with the king. Yet All this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai, that stinking Jew, sitting at the king's gate. He just can't, he's got so much good happening in his life, but when he sees Mordecai, his belly just churns with hatred and bitterness. And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, and they're a nice bunch by the sound of it, let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. Doesn't waste any time. Next morning he's off to this banquet, but this evening and so on, he gets these carpenters out, and they're going to construct this 50 cubit high gallows on which Mordecai is going to be hung, or probably in those days actually impaled. Not looking good for Mordecai, because Haman, after all, is the prime minister. He's the top dog. He actually more or less runs the country. I don't think the king does a huge amount apart from party and drink and spend time with his harem. So things aren't looking too good at this stage. Down to chapter 6. That night, that very night, the king could not sleep. It says in the Hebrew, the sleep of the king fled. That's unusual. Here's a guy that probably drinks quite a lot, eats quite a lot. And this particular night, it just so happens he can't sleep. It just so happens an unusual bout of insomnia. It just so happens. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. So he says, well, I can't sleep. Bring me something maybe fairly boring, like the recent history of my empire. And they go and get the book and open it up and find a place to read. And verse 2 says, it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So isn't this amazing? You get these chronicles of the history of the Persian Empire. It just so happens that it opens on the place where the record of Mordecai, a warning of the attempted assassination, has been recorded. You know, it so happens the king wants to be read to. He could have asked for more wine, perhaps. He could have asked for perhaps a soothing harp music, or perhaps someone play the bagpipes and put him to sleep. But no, he says, I want somebody to read to me. Go and get the history books. And then, of all the histories you could open up at, it just so happens to land on the page that talks about how Mordecai actually helped the king to escape assassination. Wow. Verse 3, then the king said, oh, and what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, well, actually, nothing at all. I said, what? Surely somebody who saved my life from assassination, surely must have given the guy some sort of super reward, didn't we? No. Really? So that was like, how did that happen? How did something as good as that get overlooked by the king? It just happened at the time to be overlooked. It just happens this particular evening that the king's now thinking, oh, hang on a second. This guy saved my life. He needs to be rewarded. Verse 4, and the king said, who's in the court at the moment? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he prepared for him. The timing here is quite a coincidence. The king's just found out that he owes his life to Mordecai and wants to reward him just at the moment that Haman arrived to say, I want to hang the guy. Just happens? The king's servants said to him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, well, call him in. So Haman came in and the king asked him, Haman, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman, who was slightly puffed up and arrogant, thought in his heart, well, hang on, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, oh, well, O king, for the man whom the king delights to honour, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has the royal crest placed on its head, then let this Robin horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, somebody pretty important as well, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honour, then parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. And in his mind's eye, Haman sees himself being taken through the city with people shouting, Amen, Hallelujah, Haman, as he sits on the king's horse and the king's robes and all the rest of it. Then the king said to Haman, right, fantastic idea. Hasten, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. And if only we had a camera to record those moments. Because one can only imagine how Haman's face must have changed from when he thought, oh, I'm going to be honored in a special way, to Mordecai, the Jew? I've just come to ask you to hang the guy. Didn't say that, of course. So, verse 11, Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man the king delights to honour. And his stomach must have been churning, and he must have been spitting under his breath and swearing, because this was really pretty bad. This is actually humiliation for Haman, because everybody knew that Haman hated Mordecai. People, most people at least, knew that Haman had planned to exterminate all the Jews, including Mordecai. And here's Haman having to lead Mordecai through the city and say, honor, honor, Mordecai the Jew, the king's favorite. He'd been in a pretty black mood. Afterwards, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. You know, been honored and went back to where he normally was. But Haman hastened to his house, mourning with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, oh, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. Sounds almost like a prophecy. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So the timing is just really great here, isn't it? No sign of God anywhere, and yet these things just happen at the right place, to the right people, at just the right time. I mean, how incredible that the king's sleepless and wants to be read to and finds out about Mordecai, and just the man who turns up at that moment is Haman. Wow. Anyway, chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. I don't imagine Haman felt particularly good at this moment, but at least he's in the king's presence and the beautiful queen, and maybe he's just wondering what to do about Mordecai afterwards. Verse 2, on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, okay, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half my kingdom. It shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, very respectful, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated, exterminated. Had it just been us being sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue. I would not raise that with you. It's just slavery we're going into. Although the enemy would never compensate for the king's loss. She's saying, look, something as just as little as complete national slavery, I would have not bothered you, my lord. But I'm going to be killed, and all my kindred. And the king Ahasuerus, verse 5, answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he? And where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? This is like, what? And I don't know whether he's particularly bothered about the Jewish people. I suspect Ahasuerus would not be, but this is his queen that somebody wants to kill. It's like, who? Somebody's going to plan to kill my queen, who belongs to me and her people? Who is this? Who is this guy? Let me know. And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman, no doubt pointing straight at him. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Wow, I mean, that's... It just so happens this is probably the most dramatic way possible. You could pin this on Haman. He's there in front of the king and the queen. The king's starting to rage that somebody's going to plot and plan to kill his queen and all her people. It turns out to be this guy at the table, Haman. So the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and probably, it says, went or stormed into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. He'd been around a little bit, Haman. He thought, didn't like the look in his eyes. But probably Esther's thinking, I'm not sure this is going to play out yet, because I never told him before that I'm a Jew. And maybe he's not going to be overly keen to find that out now. And who knows what he's going to do. And Haman's thinking, the queen's a Jew? I didn't know she was a Jew. Oh, my word. And the king's livid, and she's a Jew, and she's the queen, and I'm in trouble. Verse 8. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, unfortunately, Haman had fallen across the couch where the Esther was. A Jewish tradition, which probably means nothing, says that the angel Gabriel had actually pushed him over at that point. Well, maybe not. Then the king said, what? Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? So it just so happened that as the king came back in storming and livid, it just so happened that Haman had fallen over the couch that the queen was lying on, obviously giving an impression of something less than proper. It's like, oh my word, what is this guy up to? So that was it. He's dead now. He's finished. And it says, as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face, put some sort of, you know, covering over his head, and led him off, I guess blindfolded. His time is now up. It just so happened. Verse 9, now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, hey, look, king, almighty king, marvelous divine ruler, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. The king said, hang him on it, or probably impale him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and then the king's wrath subsided. You don't want to anger a king of this type. So Haman, he was high a day or two before. Now he's high again at the moment. He's 50 cubits up in the air, impaled on this gallows structure. And just interesting how all this just sort of happened and almost, you couldn't write a story like this. It just happened to all work out so perfectly. And of course, Haman's comeuppance does rather demonstrate the risk of trying to do harm to other people if you hold your place there. Turn to Psalms 7, verses 14 to 16. Psalms 7, verses 14 to 16. You know, some people, even today, like to plot and plan to do bad things to other people and to harm them, to cause trouble and to get them into trouble. There are some people like that, but the scripture warns that that can come right back on you. Verse 14 of Psalm 7, behold, the wicked travails with iniquity, conceives trouble, brings forth falsehood. He made a pit and dug it out and has fallen into the ditch which he made. He's dug a hole, and guess who's in it? He is. Verse 16, his trouble shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down on his own crown, as in the crown of his head. So, yeah, you dig a pit, you're going into it.
Absolutely.
You plot and plan trouble, boing, right back on your own head. Let's look at Proverbs 26 and verse 27. I can't imagine any of us plot trouble for other people. You better not. But there are plenty of people around us that do, you know, try and dig holes for others. And the scripture really gives a strong warning. You really don't want to be playing that game because these things can come right back. So Proverbs 26 and verse 27. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it. And he who rolls a stone will have it roll back on him. You dig a pit for others, that is, and you're going to end up in it. And you roll a stone up, and it's going to roll right back over you and crush you. I think I've seen some cartoons like that with Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, where Roadrunner is zooming along, and Wile E. Coyote is on the side of a sort of rolling this big boulder up a hill to try and make sure he gets to the top, and then drop it, and Roadrunner, as he goes hearing past, and of course, it doesn't happen. Usually, at the end of the story somewhere, you just see Wile E. Coyote sort of squashed under this very large boulder, as is fitting. Okay, let's go back to Esther, chapter 8. On that day, verse 1, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. I guess that's all of his property, land, and so on, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. You know, he was her older cousin who had raised her from childhood. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. And of course, to give the signet ring to Mordecai meant essentially Mordecai is now prime minister. He's now the one who's going to effectively make most of the day-to-day decisions in the Persian Empire. He has the king's signet ring. It's like a sort of power of attorney. Gives him a great deal of authority, just as Haman had had. But the trouble at the moment is that the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed, and the king had already given a law that says the Jews are to be exterminated on the 13th of the 12th month. The fact that Haman's dead hasn't changed that. So verse 3, now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So I guess that implies again she'd gone of her own initiative before the king. And again, that's a mark of courage. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, very courteous lady, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So Haman's taken care of, but there's still business outstanding. Then the king said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree for the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So, okay, well, that's fine. He's not really, it seems, too bothered, actually, with running the empire. He's got other women and parties to attend. You write a letter and deal with it appropriately and put my name on it and use my signet ring and on you go. So the king's verse 9, by the way, is the longest verse in the Bible, if you're interested. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language, everybody. And he wrote in the name of the king, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. This is going to be, okay, he's written a new edict. It's going to countermand the former one. And now they've got these guys on royal horses, fast royal horses, to carry this off to India and to Ethiopia and everywhere else. And that'd take a little while because the Persian Empire was pretty big. It was, they reckon, about 3 million square miles, you know, roughly the size of the continental United States of America. And if you're going to carry a letter from Washington to San Antonio, or Washington to San Diego, or San Francisco, or whatever you want to take it, take a while. So off they go. Verse 11, by these letters the king permitted the Jews who are in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So it's a self-defense edict. They're not allowed to go, you know, hunting down others, but if they're attacked by anybody on this particular day, they are allowed to use lethal force to defend themselves. So it's defensive only, but they can also plunder, if they wanted, the possessions of those who'd attack them. And it's restricted to one day, the 13th day of Adar. So you get one day to defend yourself, but that should be enough, because only on that one day are they allowed to be attacked by the first edict. Verse 13, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published to all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Then the couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command. And the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. So, in a sense, job largely done now, because this is a countermanding instruction that says, we can't stop other people attacking you, because that's what the first edict of the law of Medes and Persians says, but actually a new one says, you're now empowered by the king's command to kill in defense of yourselves. That's actually quite handy. Verse 15, now Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. So it's quite interesting, I guess, in a sense, that the city were glad. I suppose what you see of Haman's character, he was probably not a very nice guy. Clearly super-duper self-important, arrogant, almost beyond belief. So self-important, and had to have people bow and scrape before him. And I guess the citizens of the city come across that and didn't really like it. And here's Mordecai, a much nicer guy, much a wiser guy, much more genteel guy. And so the city's really quite happy. Well, there's Mordecai. He's far better than Haman ever was. Verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. It's all really quite interesting. The Jews are now delighted, because for several months they've been laboring under the absolute fear that they're going to be exterminated by the king's command, so you can't really, you know, you couldn't really resist that easily. You might get a few people here and there would fight against it, but if the king's command says his citizens are to rise up and kill the Jews, so you're not going to do very much in the way of defense. But now, out of the blue, amazingly, because of Esther's intervention and Mordecai's wisdom, now suddenly a new edict. We are allowed to defend ourselves against anybody who attacks us. Wow. And not only that, but Mordecai the Jew is essentially one of the king's very, very top men, dressed in finery with a great golden crown, and the people of the city are delighted that a Jew is essentially their day-to-day leader. Wow. Then it says in verse 17, many of the people of the land became Jews. Interesting. It doesn't, I guess, really, it's not really clear whether that means in a sort of cultural sense they started to imitate and copy you know, Jewish customs and dances and, you know, learn Hebrew and things of that nature and seek out the scriptures, the Torah, or whether they actually went through a conversion process. But either way, many, it says, not just one or two, it says many people across the empire said, oh, I'm going to be a Jew. So they've gone from being the nation that's going to be exterminated to now lots of folk want to share sort of Jewish ideas and customs down to chapter 9 then. We mentioned just in passing that verse 9 there, chapter 8 verse 9 is the longest chapter in the Bible. And that's just collecting useless information. Shortest chapter in the Bible, shortest verse in the Bible, I should say.
Jesus wept.
Yeah, shortest verse in the Bible is Jesus wept. Just two words in John 11:35. So you like to make notes of interesting bits and pieces. Esther 8:9 is the longest verse, and John 11:35 is the shortest verse, just with two words, Jesus wept. Anyway, chapter 9 of Esther. Now in the 12th month, so this is the, remember, the lots, the Purim, were cast, and it was month 12. In the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. So reverse the curse. Supposed to be the Jews wiped out, and turns out actually it's vice versa. Verse 2, the Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all the people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them, for Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. So it appears that, you know, some people still hated the Jews. Actually, it gives a few numbers in a moment or two, but some people took advantage of this first edict, and off they went to try and kill the Jews. But of course now the Jews were waiting and prepared and empowered legally to defend themselves and kill those that might attack them. Like I said earlier, it wasn't a go out hunting people and kill them. The Jews were permitted self-defense for that one day. And this was the particular day. And obviously they were helped by other Persians, because Mordecai was now so famous, such a powerful individual in the king's sort of government, a very prominent individual, and people are probably thinking, you know what? I think I'd rather be in Mordecai's side. I think I'd rather be found fighting for Mordecai's people than fighting against Mordecai's people, because Mordecai is the big head honcho. He's next to the king, and what Mordecai says gets done. I think I'll side with Mordecai and his people. No great surprise there. But again, interesting that these things just sort of happen, and now Mordecai, because he's where he is, he's now the right man at the right time in the right place, means that if there's any risk at all of the Jews being overpowered, suddenly, because Mordecai is who he is, suddenly it just so happens that many Persians have become Jewish, either in reality or in culture, and have become very positive towards the Jewish people. And it just so happens they want to help Mordecai's people. Just happened, sort of. Verse 5. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, which isn't a huge number, I suppose, exactly. It's not slaughtering thousands and thousands and thousands, at least not in this capital, but it seems odd in a sense also that, bearing in mind that King Ahasuerus is married to a Jew, and that his top man is Mordecai the Jew, there's still 500 numpties that decided they were going to go out and kill the Jews. So whether they're relatives of Haman, I'm not too sure, but clearly they were on the wrong side of the battle. So 500 were killed. Also, verse 7 through 9, Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adalia, Aridatha, Parmashta, Arisai, Aridai, and Vajezatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamaditha, the enemy of the Jews, they killed. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So Haman had 10 sons, and it looks like they, perhaps not great surprise, might have been in the group trying to attack the Jews. I suppose maybe a bit of vengeance for their father, right, or other reasons. Anyway, they were killed, all 10 of them. And on that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan the citadel was brought to the king. But notice, sorry, in verse 10, the Jews didn't lay any hand on the plunder. They were permitted to, by the edict, to sort of kill anybody who attacked them and have plunder. But I guess the Jews weren't in it for, you know, financial reasons. They were happy to be able to defend themselves. But they didn't want any goods. They didn't go out trying to grasp and get and be greedy. So they didn't take any plunder. Verse 12. The king said to Queen Esther, okay, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan and Citadel and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? He wondered. Now, what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done. He's still quite enamored with Queen Esther. She still has great favor. He says, okay, you people have killed 500 of my people here in the city, and plus the 10 sons of Haman, who knows what they've done elsewhere. I'll get the numbers eventually brought back to me by the news reporters, but anything else you want doing while we're at it? Esther said, well, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow according to today's decree, and also let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. They're already dead. This is just a public spectacle. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 more men at Shushan, but did not lay a hand on the plunder. And I guess maybe Mordecai was able to figure out that not all the enemies of the Jews have yet been dealt with. There's still a few hundred lurking around, and one extra day was necessary. But either way, it took 2 days in Shushan, but only the one day in the rest of the empire. Verse 16, the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but did not lay a hand on the plunder, because they were not after material acquisitions. There was no greed here. They're just delighted to be able to protect themselves. And 75,000 died, which is quite a large number. And I guess, like I said earlier, that'd be the other Persians and so on helping the Jews because of Mordecai and so on. So that was the dramatic deliverance of the people of Judah, the Jews, from guaranteed extermination. Like we said last week, in a sense, you could almost see Haman as like a Nazi. Second World War period, 1940, I guess, 1 or 2 through to 1945, the Nazis, the German people, exterminated about 6 million Jews. And that's what Haman wanted to do, exterminate every living Jew, because they're Jewish. Kill them all. And it seems almost undoubtedly that we can't see God's hand overtly here. We can't see Satan either. But who would want the Jews killed more than Satan? Particularly back in the days of Esther. Because if you kill all the Jews, then the Messiah cannot come, because he's going to come in the line of Judah. So anyway, verse 17. Tells us about the introduction of this festival called the Purim. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. On the 14th day of the month, they rested. and made it a day of feasting and gladness. So around the provinces, 13th is when they killed their enemies. 14th was an extra few hundred killed in Shushan, the main city. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day, as well as on the 14th day. And on the 15th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and for sending presents to one another. Because it was a day of, you know, it was a day of happiness. Yesterday, the 13th, we were to be wiped out. We turned the tables, thanks to Esther and Mordecai. And now the day after, on the 14th, we can relax. We've been saved. We can have parties and banquets, and we can send gifts and presents, and we can rejoice and have great music, which is what the Feast of Purim is really all about. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish among them, this is going to be ordained now, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the days in which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them, and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot, which Haman had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. So just a sort of summary, I guess, of the story. So they call these days Purim, or Purim, after the name Pur, meaning, you know, a lot that you cast. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning the matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who should join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. Because it was dramatic. You didn't see a mighty miracle like bolts of lightning and fire and brimstone. You didn't see the earth opening up. You didn't see the Red Sea opening up. And nothing like that. No prophet arrived and, you know, stamped his feet and things happened. And yet, all these coincidences just came along, and suddenly the Jewish people are reprieved and escape. And so Purim is a very big festival, I believe, among the Jewish people. It's a festive festival. I think most keep it on the 14th of Adar. I think in Jerusalem it's probably the 15th, because they dwell behind walls, and that was part of the sort of rules. And they have happy meals, not as in McDonald's. I mean, they have festive meals. They have drink. They have poetry. They have plays. They have masquerades. The Book of Esther is read usually more than once on the Feast of Purim. And I think in the synagogues, when you get the name Haman read out loud, it's read out loud, I should say, when it's read out loud, I think people stamp their feet, hiss, and they go like rattles, they rattle to drown out the name of Haman. I think the scripture says to blot out the name of the Haman the Amalekite. So all of that noise happens, and it sounds to me like it's probably quite a good day to join the Jews in terms of having quite a fun time. And it goes all back looking at the memory of this dramatic escape, dramatic deliverance. Anyway, picking up in verse 29, then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them. And as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting, so the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. And of course, here you are, what are we now, nearly 2,500 years later, and the Jewish people are still observing the festival of Purim in the memory of these sort of dramatic events, even though God's hand isn't visible. But clearly, just too many things just happened for it to be other than the hand of God working quietly behind the scenes. Chapter 10, fairly short. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on all the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? Because all these nations kept very detailed historic accounts of what they were up to. And so somewhere, I guess, if they ever find it, will be these chronicles of the Medes and Persians, and in there is going to be a lot of stuff about Mordecai. Verse 3, for Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace, shalom, to all his kindred. And so that doesn't end the Bible study yet, but that does end the main part of the book of Esther. And it's an interesting book. I think the lessons one would wish to learn from it are, even though you and I don't see God's hand explicitly, overtly, visibly in our lives, things happen. Things can happen. And God's able to orchestrate events and to open doors and to close doors, or if necessary, open windows and close windows, and to ensure that the right people are in the right place at the right time. And so we can always trust that God can work things out, even though we don't necessarily see his hand visibly, so to speak. But we mentioned that, you know, God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther. It's the only book in the Bible where God's name is not mentioned. Other than the fact that if you look close enough, apparently, we won't do this in detail, you can find God's name hidden in the Hebrew. Now, since you and I don't read Hebrew, we're not going to actually find it, but the name is hidden, encoded in the Hebrew. I'll give you the four verses where the name Jehovah appears in Hebrew, and we'll just look at two of them. You won't see anything in English, but at least you'll know they're there. It would be chapter 1, verse 20. Excuse me, chapter 1, verse 20. The name Jehovah appears in the Hebrew, hidden, coded. In chapter 5, verse 4, and we will look at that one. Chapter 5, verse 13, we look at that one. And chapter 7, verse 7. Those are four places where the name of God, Jehovah or Yahweh, if you prefer, appears hidden in the Hebrew. It doesn't just appear Jehovah, it's actually coded. Let's turn to 5:4. I'll show you what it is. I'd say you can't see it in English because it's Hebrew. And these are what they call acrostics. Acrostics are where the first letter, for example, of every word in a sentence makes up another word. For example, you might have heard the term remember it takes action. Rita. Rita, R-I-T-A. Remember it takes action. And sometimes when you go to an office, you might find a little sticker up, R-I-T-A, Rita. That just reminds people, oh, remember it takes action. Because Rita is the first letter of each word, and remember it takes action. Or some people, on a more religious note, the word faith, for example, faith, F-A-I-T-H, is forsaking all, I trust him. Forsaking all, I trust him. The first letter of those words spells F-A-I-T-H, faith. That's what they call an acrostic. But what you've got here in those four verses I mentioned is an acrostic of the name Jehovah. So 5:4 in English doesn't help as much in English, but just to show you where it is, it says, so Esther answered, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I've prepared for him. Okay, in Hebrew, The expression, let the king and Haman come today, right? Let the king and Haman come today. In Hebrew, that's four words. The first letter of those four words spells Jehovah, or Yahweh, if you like, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton. That's the name of God, Jehovah, or Yahweh. And so, let the king and Haman come today. In Hebrew, is four words. The first letter is Y-H-V-H, Jehovah. Or, verse 13 of the same chapter, in English you read, yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate. Okay. The expression in English, this avails me nothing. This avails me nothing. In Hebrew is four words. And the last letter of each of the four words spells Jehovah. J-H-V-H, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in Hebrew. So if you want more information, you could always look up Mr. Bullinger's Companion Bible. It's got an entire appendix looking at the subject of God's name hidden in the Hebrew, in the book of Esther. There's also a couple of other names there as well, apart from Jehovah. So God is hidden in the sense that we don't see his name anywhere. But if you look in the Hebrew, you can find it sort of hidden there if you look hard enough. And some old manuscripts written in Hebrew, strangely enough, when you get to those verses I just mentioned, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the J-H-V-H, is actually written bigger than the rest of the letters in those words. So as you come along, you think, oh, hang on a second. Why is that J and that H and that V and that H written much bigger than the rest? Oh, it's Jehovah. All right. Well, that's cunning. So the book of Esther, we don't see God explicitly. He's behind the scenes, he's orchestrating events, he's working things out that it just so happens that the Jewish people are delivered from extermination. And we don't see God's name. It just so happens, if you look in the Hebrew and look hard enough, it's hidden away there. So an interesting book in many ways, the only book in the Bible that doesn't have God's name in it. And yet, as I said earlier, to the Jews, it's one of the most popular of all books, and I think a very interesting story. Okay, with that, brethren, we'll conclude today's Bible study.